Bolin was in the clouds. They blanketed the mountains like a thick, dense fog, and even though it hadn't yet begun to rain, Bolin's fatigues were drenched as much from condensation as his own sweat. Like Kissinger, who stalked the rocky terrain 20 yards to his left, Bolin was carrying an Unger Stinson Survivor Series crossbow, loaded and ready to fire. Bracketed to the stock for quick reloading were two additional jag-tipped bolts. His Desert Eagle was close at hand in a web holster, and slung across his back was an Indian-issue M16, equipped with an undermounted Remington 870 pump shotgun. Rounding out his gear was a steel-bladed Kozar hunting knife, strapped to his thigh, and a belt clip holding backup ammunition, as well as three AN-3 series frag grenades. Perched on his forehead was a pair of infrared night goggles. He'd used them briefly while coming up over the mountain, but found them too disorienting and had taken them off. For all the options they provided, Bolin's arsenal came at a price. The extra weight, added to that of his soaked outfit and a fanny pack stocked with a canteen and food rations, only increased the strain of trying to acclimate to the high altitude. Bolin's lungs were already beginning to pain him with their demands for more oxygen than the thin mountain air could provide. But at least he and Kissinger were finally heading downhill. The Gurkhas, predictably, were nowhere to be seen. They'd taken the lead and vanished into the mist shortly after the border cross. Bolin took it on faith that they were close by. The insertion point had been chosen not only because of its distance from the nearest checkpoint, but also because, had the diversionary ploy at Kashgar Pass failed to pull troops away from the mountains, it was the area least likely to be heavily patrolled due to the instability of the ground cover. The mountainside was layered with choss, a flimsy aggregate of small rocks that crumbled readily underfoot, making it at best a nuisance to walk across. Every few steps, Bolin was forced to shift his weight to avoid slipping on the perilous terrain, in the process sending pebbles into a roll down the path of least resistance. He and the others were relying on crossbows for the downhill journey for the simple reason that the mere echo of a lone gunshot would be enough to dislodge the choss, triggering a landslide. Bolin wasn't the only one raising a clatter. All around him, there was an almost constant patter of small slides, some caused by Kissinger and the Gurkhas, others by the drone of planes flying above the clouds overhead, or the mere pull of gravity on clusters of stone weakened over time by the elements. After another 30 yards, Bolin and Kissinger converged near an outcropping and paused to catch their breath, sitting on a pair of smooth boulders that rose up through the Earth's crust like large eggs. Kissinger, too, was making do without his goggles.
Are we having fun yet?
Walk in the park.
Bolin cupped a hand around his wrist and illuminated his watch, checking the time and getting a read off its embedded compass. The plan was to head downhill on a northwesterly course until they reached the Zhangzhou River. The river coursed through a narrow canyon pocked with small caves situated a few yards above the waterline. By the time they reached the caves, it would be close to dawn. There the men would rest until the sun rose, then rendezvous at the first bend in the river and plan their next move. At least, that was the plan. Soon after they'd resumed their trek, Bolin and Kissinger split off once again. Before long, he'd dropped below the cloud line. He was grateful for the increased visibility. Glancing down the side of the mountain, he saw that he was nearly halfway to the river. It shone faintly in the distance, snaking along the base of the mountain for several miles before heading inland. As for the clouds, they formed an unbroken firmament across the entire night sky. As Bolin stared northward, a shaft of lightning reached out of the clouds and stabbed at the desert floor below. The storm was heading toward him. He continued on his way, fighting the urge to move faster. He had covered another few dozen yards when he heard a commotion behind him, roughly 50 yards to his right. He stopped and dropped to a crouch, listening intently. He stared past them and resorted to the night goggles, hoping for a better look at whatever was moving overhead. He knew it wasn't Kissinger, and it seemed unlikely one of the Gurkhas had doubled back behind him. The mountain men had also told them that, dumb as they were, even yaks knew better than to venture the loose ground. That left one disturbing possibility, and as he peered through the infrared lenses, Bolin's suspicions were confirmed. Uphill, Skulking down the same faint path Bolin had forged through the Choss was a uniformed member of the Chinese Border Patrol. Instead of a crossbow, he was armed with a conventional bow and arrow. The bow was arched, the drawstring pulled taut. The man was taking aim at Bolin. The executioner instinctively threw himself forward, landing hard on the slope. An arrow whispered past and caromed off the rocks to his left. He wasn't about to give the man a second shot. He lined the patrolman in the sights of his crossbow and let fly with a shaft of his own. The soldier lost his balance. Bolin quickly yanked free a fresh bolt and was fitting it into the crossbow when a fresh hail of stone tumbled past him. There were obviously more of them than before, and they were coming at him louder and in larger sizes. The next thing Bolin knew, the wounded border guard was crying out as an entire sheet of Choss broke free beneath him.
Oh, shit!
Feeling the ground begin to quake beneath him, Bolin jerked off his goggles and struggled back to his feet. By then, however, the avalanche was already nearly upon him. Bolin had a split second to react. The swath was too wide for him to have any chance of sidestepping it, and trying to outrun it downhill was a fool's game. All that was left was for him to make sure he wasn't dragged under. He sprang from a crouch, meeting the slide head-on, leaping as high as possible while the rocks surged beneath him. He came down atop the slide and battled to stay there. Out of the corner of his eye, he spotted Kissinger racing toward him. There was nothing the armorer could do to help.
Striker!
But he was soon forced to back off. Glancing around him, Bolin saw that a few of the larger boulders were apparently riding a cushion of smaller rock. Unlike the others, they weren't rolling end over end, but rather sliding in place. He threw himself at the nearest one and grabbed hold. His weight, however, sank the rock enough that it too began to roll, forcing him to let go to try his luck with another. The next large slab held under his weight. Although he was pelted mercilessly by other stones and rocks, he was safe, at least for the moment, coasting down the hill as if aboard some monolithic surfboard hung up on a slow-moving swell. The avalanche continued to grow in size as it charged downhill, prying loose the Choss in its path and adding it to its bulk. That worked to Bolin's advantage, as he found himself not only lifted up by the rising crest, but also drifting back from its edge. After more than 100 yards, however, the slide came to strata made of firm bedrock that refused to feed it. At nearly the same time, the mountain began to level off. Almost instantly, the avalanche began to diminish and lose its momentum. Several times earlier, Bolin had seen thick trees snapped like twigs under the slide's sheer force, but now trees of the same girth were holding their ground, forcing the slide to move around them. And each time the slide encountered another tree, it was sliced and forced to scatter in a wider swath. Soon the crest began to subside, and Bolin felt himself being drawn back toward the slide's leading edge. In time, the boulder he was perched upon would hit ground and pitch forward, throwing him like a first-time buckaroo being tossed off a rodeo brahmin. He had other cause for concern. The river was up ahead, and the avalanche still seemed likely to remain intact long enough to reach the water. One way or another, Bolin needed to find a way off the ride. Seeing another stand of trees just up ahead, he decided to make his move. He rose to his knees and held his arms out at his sides, hoping he would pass under a tree whose lower branches were within reach. 20 yards directly ahead of him, an ancient poplar drooped slightly forward, as if crouching to meet the slide head-on. Bolin braced himself, his eyes on a thick limb extending out 10 feet up from the ground. At the last second, however, the slide shifted beneath him.
Fuck!
His boulder followed suit, veering directly into the trunk. The huge rock slammed home. Its sheer weight and momentum was too much for the poplar. It gave way, even as Bolin was being thrown forward by the impact. Instead of grabbing the limb, Bolin crashed into it, shoulder first. The blow stunned him, and the next thing he knew, he was once again being swept along, half buried in the moving juggernaut. Within a matter of seconds, he found himself being carried over the edge of a eroded canyon that led into the churning waters of the Zhangzhou River. Bolin felt the sensation of cold water rushing over him. Then everything went black. As he began to regain consciousness, Bolin's first vague sensation was that of water lapping against him. Thoughts drifted through his mind, as thin as clouds, a jumble of images and memories. He didn't know where he was, He was in darkness, surrounded by a tangle of loose brush and driftwood. Water was seeping through the debris. Nearby, he could hear the river and rain. It was coming down hard, but it wasn't landing on him. Lightning flashed overhead. In the wake of illumination, he saw that he was lying on a rock shelf in a cave situated just above the river. As the water roared past, more of it spilled up onto the ledge and trailed under him. He thought back, trying to fathom what had happened after he'd tumbled into the river. The current had to have dragged him along, he figured, and cast him aside as it rounded a bend. But how far had it taken him? Was this where he was supposed to meet the others? Where was Kissinger? Bolin tried to move, but couldn't. A splintered tree trunk lay across his legs. Part of it was still half submerged in the river, jostling back and forth in the current so that it gnawed at his shins like a dull saw. Bolin rallied his strength and reached down, trying to push the obstruction free. The trunk slid off his leg, and a branch whipped past his face as the current pulled the tree back into the river and carried it away. Bolin wasn't sure, but it seemed to him the water level had risen in just the past minute. He stared out and waited for the next burst of lightning. As it flashed, he saw the river surging past and caught a glimpse of canyon wall on the other side of the water. He could see and hear the rain more clearly now. The storm wasn't letting up. If anything, the rain was coming down harder. If the river kept swelling, he realized it would soon overrun its banks and fill the cave. Rendezvous point or not, he couldn't stay here. Slowly, Bolin pulled himself to his feet. There wasn't a part of his body that didn't ache, but he was alive and in one piece, which was more than he'd hoped for when the slide had carried him into the river. And as long as he was alive, there was a mission to be carried out. The cave was small, so he had to crouch as he took inventory. He'd been stripped of his crossbow, as well as the M16 and his grenade belt. That left the knife and his Desert Eagle. His cell phone was gone too, no doubt transmitting from somewhere deep beneath the avalanche. Like Grimaldi, he'd lost contact with the outside world. For now, at least, he was on his own. Bolin unzipped his rations kit. Water had seeped in, sogging everything except for his canteen and some protein bars, sealed in a waterproof pouch along with matches and a small penlight. Famished, Bolin tore off the wrapper to one of the bars and quickly devoured the snack, washing it down with a few sips from the canteen. A wave crashed onto the ledge, adding to the pool of water collecting around his feet. Already, it was up to his ankles. He didn't have much time. Bolin groped through the darkness, making his way around the debris, feeling the cave walls for a way out. There was none. He moved to the mouth of the cave and reached out. The rain pelted his fingers as he ran his hands along the canyon wall above him. There was nothing to grab hold of, no way of pulling himself up to higher ground. Bolin gazed out of the cave, trying to get a better idea of what he was up against. The river was more than 40 yards wide, brown with silt, frothing from the current's pull. Another felled tree drifted past, and Bolin was forced to step back as it raked the mouth of the cave. Bolin looked down at the debris strewn across the cave floor. It was mostly twigs and small branches, but there were a few larger limbs, two as thick as his leg, another the diameter of a bread loaf. Working fast, he tossed aside the smaller branches, laying out those he could use in some semblance of a row. Next, he tugged off his camo shirt, then unstrapped the knife from his thigh. In a few minutes, he'd cut the shirt to ribbons, leaving him with a set of makeshift lashings. Once he'd strapped the branches together, he wedged twigs into the gaps. When he was finished, Bolin had himself a small raft. He had doubts it would support his weight, but it would have to. Wading through the quickly rising water, he carried his creation back to the mouth of the cave. By now, his eyes had adjusted to the dark. He stood before the opening and stared out at the river, waiting for the right moment. A few minutes later, he saw another tree drifting toward him. It was smaller than the last one, but denser and lying lower in the brackish water. Bolin waited until the last possible second, then dove from the cave, raft clutched to his chest. He landed atop the tree, and as he'd hoped, it buttressed the raft, helping to displace his weight. He dipped briefly below the current, then bobbed back to the surface. The raft was pinned beneath his chest, allowing him to free his hands and secure a better grip on the tree. As with the avalanche, there was little more he could do but hold on and let nature play out its hand. The river carved deeper into the canyons as it carried Bolin along. When lightning flashed, it was silent and behind his back. It was hard for him to hear thunder over the roar of the current, but he sensed the worst of the storm had passed. Soon, the rain began to let up. The storm was moving into the mountains. The river, however, continued to move swiftly. After a few miles, it came to another sharp bend, and Bolin's ungainly craft was pushed up against a mound of flotsam jammed into a crevasse. The steep, pitched walls offered no escape, so Bolin stayed put, waiting for the tree beneath him to unsnag. The river was cold, and his legs were starting to go numb. There was nothing he could do about it. After a few minutes, the tree finally broke free of the snag, and he was back out in the current. A mile later, he felt the river dip. Whitecaps began to appear on the surface, and boulders began to appear above the waterline. He was entering a stretch of rapids.
Oh, will this shit ever end?
Beneath him, the tree began to come apart. Outer branches snapped against the large rocks, destabilizing Bolin's position. He began to drop lower in the water, twice wincing with pain as his knees bounded off unseen boulders. He shifted forward as best he could, trying to buy time as he scanned the way before him, looking for an opportunity to bail before the rapids dashed him against the rocks. The gauntlet of boulders was unmerciful. When he caromed off one, it felt as if he'd been broadsided by a small truck. His entire left side went numb, and when it was followed up by yet another harsh blow, the wind was knocked from Bolin's lungs. Stunned, he gave up the fight and was about to surrender to the rapids when they finally relented, flinging him down one last cascade and depositing him into a lake. The water steadied around him.
Thank God.
He dog paddled with one arm until the feeling came back to the other, then slowly made his way toward the lake's edge. Fatigued, he stopped halfway to the bank and turned onto his back, splaying his arms and legs so that he could float in place. He stared up at the sky. The moon shone through a break in the clouds. He also saw a small plane flying high overhead. Observation craft, he thought. He doubted anyone could see him, but to be safe, he flipped over so that only his head was above the water. With slow strokes, he made his way toward shore, taking care not to make waves. The lake's shoreline was gravelly. Once out of the water, Bolin crawled across the rocks and quickly took cover beneath a stand of small trees. A breeze rustled the trees. Bare-chested, bleeding from countless scrapes, Bolin shivered.
Oh, this sucks.
He sat at the base of one of the trees and drained his canteen, then finished off the last of his protein bars. He was contemplating his next move, battling his body's cry for sleep, when the breeze shifted, carrying with it a cloying, fetid stench.
Oh.
Bolin knew the smell all too well. It was the smell of rotting flesh. Bolin rose to his feet. The odor was coming from behind him, back through the trees. The storm had apparently skirted the lake because the ground was relatively dry, and after he'd ventured 20 yards into the brush, Bolin saw boot prints. He placed his foot next to one of the prints. They were roughly the same size. A thought flashed quickly through Bolin's mind, the memory of a mission 10 years ago when he and Jack Grimaldi had wound up sharing the same room at a hotel outside Kosovo. One morning, Grimaldi had put on one of Bolin's shoes by mistake. It fit, and he didn't realize the mistake until he'd gone to put on his other shoe and saw it was for the same foot. The hairs rose on the back of Bolin's neck.
No, it can't be.
He moved faster, following the prints past a cluster of wildflowers to a clearing. 30 yards away, lying face down in the moonlight, was a body. Holding his breath, Bolin approached the corpse, or at least what was left of it. Vultures or crows had poked through the dead man's clothes and picked at his flesh. His entire backside had been eaten away to the bone, and there was little left of his right leg but a few shreds of mangled flesh. Decomposition had set in, accounting for the smell, and maggots squirmed amid the entrails. Bolin found a stick and braced himself, then carefully turned the body over. The man's face had been eaten away, leaving only cartilage and the gleaming bones of his skull. It wasn't Grimaldi. There were a few long strands of straight blonde hair clinging to a small patch of scalp on one side of the skull. Grimaldi's hair was black and curly. And although the Stony Man pilot had served a tour of duty with the Air Force years ago, he'd long since hung up his dog tags. The man lying dead on the ground still had his tags, dangling by a chain from what was left of his neck. Bolin flipped the tags over and flashed his penlight on them. Harmon Brown, U.S. Air Force, one of the missing Rangers. Bolin slowly stood and snapped off his light, relying on the moon as he began to scour the clearing. He found more tracks, made by smaller boots, as well as dozens of spent shells, most of the same caliber. Bolin picked one up and inspected it. It was for an AK-47, the Chinese military's preferred assault rifle. Off near a cluster of rocks, there were two blackened craters as well, caused most likely by grenades or mortars. Too much firepower expended for just one man. The others had to be close by, contributing to the odor of death that still choked the night air around him. Bolin saw that the boot prints led in the direction of the rocks. He followed them, but stopped after a few steps. Something was moving behind the rocks. He sidestepped, taking cover behind a nearby tree. He aimed his Desert Eagle at the rocks and waited. Moments later, an animal trotted into view. In the dark, it was hard for Bolin to tell whether it was a wild dog or a jackal. There was a severed arm clamped in its jaws, weighing down its head slightly. Bolin wasn't about to draw attention to himself by shooting at it. Instead, he grabbed some stones and began throwing them. The animal paused, looking around, hesitant to give up its hard-earned dinner. It was only after one of the stones glanced off its hindquarters that the beast dropped the arm. Bolin moved from the tree and once more held his breath. As he'd feared, he found four more men lying sprawled behind the rocks. Except for the one missing an arm, they were more intact than the ranger out in the clearing. They lay at odd angles, stripped of their boots and weapons. Behind them were traces of a makeshift camp. Flattened grass, ration tins, discarded food wrappers. Bolin tried to imagine what might have happened. The likeliest explanation was that the men had pitched camp unaware the enemy was close by. Brown had to have ventured out, maybe to fetch water from the lake, maybe to go on patrol. He'd been followed back to the camp, unaware he was setting his men up for an ambush. Judging from the craters and spent shells, the Chinese had come in hard and fast, storming the camp before the Rangers had a chance to fully react. It had all the makings of a massacre. If the Chinese had lost soldiers, they'd been hauled away in the aftermath. Bolin wondered how the Rangers had allowed themselves to be taken out so easily. It went against their training to camp so closely together, and they couldn't have picked a worse spot. True, they'd set up camp behind the rocks, and no doubt there'd been a lookout posted for any sign of enemy approach by way of the lake. On the other hand, they'd literally backed themselves into a corner. Behind them, the canyon walls rose up almost perpendicular to the ground. It would have been far more difficult for them to go up than for the enemy to come down to them, capable of shooting them like fish in a barrel. Whatever the explanation, they'd taken it with them to their maker. All Bolin could do for them was gather their dog tags. He knew from experience that, however macabre, they were a source of solace for loved ones back home. He set about the task quickly, but was given pause when he noticed that all of the men's wounds hadn't been caused by gunfire or the bite of carnivores. The men's ears were missing, as were some of their fingers, pinkies mostly, all severed by the clean cuts from a sharp blade. The Chinese had taken souvenirs.
Filthy bastards!
A cold rage filled Bolin as he finished collecting the dog tags, sealing the tags inside his provision bag. He'd planned to change into one of the men's uniforms, but after seeing the mutilations, he couldn't bring himself to do it. The men had already been stripped of their boots. Dead or not, he wasn't about to rob any one of them of their dignity as well by leaving them naked to the elements. Instead, Bolin steeled himself against the reek of putrefaction and slowly dragged the bodies close together, setting each out in an angle of repose, then covering them with rocks and small boulders to shield them from predators. Once the grim ritual was completed, Bolin stood exhausted before the burial mound. He wasn't a man of prayer, but believed there was a higher power, and he offered the fallen soldiers a moment of silence, wishing them peace and honor in whatever world might lie beyond the one from which they'd been so cruelly dispatched. Afterward, he returned to the clearing, filled with resolve that they wouldn't have died in vain. Shrugging off his fatigue, Bolin stared down at the footprints that led him to the massacre site. The same tracks led from the carnage in a westward direction, away from the lake and through the dense foliage at the base of the canyon. Tracking the prints, Bolin soon saw signs of a trail. He began to follow it, Desert Eagle in hand, filled with savage determination. Bolin was hoping for a chance to show the ambushers just why he'd come to be known as the Executioner. Once he cleared the foliage, the path rose upward, leading to a series of switchbacks that took Bolin up the side of the canyon. The ground was solid beneath his feet, a welcome change from the brittle choss that had detoured him from his original mission. He wondered how Kissinger and the Gurkhas were faring. Perhaps once he'd reached higher ground, he could find his bearings and find a way to hook back up with them. Bolin paused just shy of the canyon's rim and glanced out, trying to commit the terrain to memory so that, if all went well, he could arrange for the retrieval of the slain rangers, ensuring a proper burial back in the States. From where he was, he couldn't see their temporary grave. Trees concealed it from view. He could see the lake, however, as well as the rapids that spilled into it. Across the gorge, he thought he detected a faint dome of light. Once again recalling the topographical map back at the airbase, he was puzzled. The only possible source of such light would have to be Monacon. But as CIA agent Jung Soo had described it, the town was as small as it was remote. Even if they had electricity, he doubted there were enough homes to give off that much illumination. That left the uranium mine, but on the map he remembered it being miles north of the search zone. Had Bolin been carried that far after losing consciousness in the river? It seemed impossible to him. There had to be another explanation. He put the matter out of his mind and turned his focus back to the moment. His legs were cramped from the climb. He massaged his calves briefly and then moved on, clearing the rise and finding himself on a vast, barren plain dotted by several small mountains and hillocks. The footprints led directly across the open plain toward the nearest rise.
Not good.
Without cover, there was no way he could advance without being spotted by sentries, which he assumed were likely posted up in the hills. Glancing to his right, he saw a dog some 40 yards away, standing its ground in front of a herd of several dozen larger beasts. They were similar in appearance to goats, but the size of oxen.
Yaks?
As Bolin watched, the herdsman appeared out of the flock, riding a dark horse. He slapped the reins and urged his horse in Bolin's direction. The dog followed suit, bounding across the flatland. Bolin slowly backtracked, easing himself down the trail he'd just climbed. He held his pistol level. If the dog tried to attack, he would have no choice but to shoot it, and, if need be, the herdsman as well. The dog, a long-haired breed Bolin was unfamiliar with, continued to race forward, then stopped and continued to bark, apparently trained only to corner any threat to the herd rather than attack it. Bolin kept his gun trained on the animal, then shifted it as the herdsman drew near, armed with an ancient flintlock rifle. Bolin kept his finger on the trigger, but held his fire. The herdsman was a boy, no more than 10. The youth seemed every bit as taken by surprise as Bolin and made no effort to aim the rifle at him. Instead, he stared at him quizzically. Bolin, bare-chested, his dark hair matted with sweat, stared back.
You are the Rambo?
Yeah, and I'm on a mission.
I am Avil the Rambo. Your mission is against soldiers?
Yes, Avil. They killed some people, good people.
They killed the father in the labor camp.
Over there?
Bolin indicated the dome of light across the canyon. The boy nodded. Apparently, Monacon had not only electricity, but also a sufficient enough supply of pirated Hollywood movies for the boy to have taught himself English. He chose his words carefully, eager to impress his favorite movie hero, miraculously brought to life before his very eyes.
The soldiers come to village looking for Falun Gong. The fathers say, leave them alone. They hurt no one.
And for that they sent him to a labor camp?
Say the father died working much, but the father was strong. The mothers say they're lying, say they kill him. I believe her.
Did your father belong to the Falun Gong?
No, but only right to leave them alone, he say.
And that's why you're in charge of the herd now? Because your father died?
I take turns with brother. He is 8.
The men who did this should be punished. Do you know where they are?
The boy, who was sitting not on a saddle but rather a folded blanket, turned and pointed to one of the hillocks with his rifle, which dwarfed him.
There. I shoot them, but I am scared. Kill me, the mother sad again.
I think there is a way you can help. You can make your mother proud.
She already proud, but I can help.
Good. Tell me, do the soldiers do anything when you herd your yaks past them?
Sometimes they laugh, point to my rifle, pretend I shot them. They fall down, get up, and laugh.
How close are you to them when they do this laughing?
They're grass on hills. Let me bring yaks for grazing. I see them making fun.
I will see that they stop laughing at you. Here's my plan.
Bolin told the boy what he had in mind, and then followed him back toward the herd, making sure to stay alongside the horse so that anyone looking down would not be able to see him. The boy stayed close to him, as if guiding back a stray that had wandered from the herd. Once they reached the yaks, the boy nudged his horse through their ranks, looking them over. Bolin had no doubt that the boy could tell the beasts apart. Finally, he pointed to one of the larger yaks.
Yaru let you ride.
Bolin eyed the creature. It was the one he would have picked, too. Yaru's coat was thicker than the others, and he felt he could ride flat on the beast's back without anyone being able to see him. As an added precaution, however, he asked to borrow the blanket the boy was using in place of a saddle. The boy shifted on the horse's back and pulled it out from under him.
The mother making it present for the father. It is special.
I'll take good care of it.
Bolin draped the blanket like a cape over his bare shoulders. The blanket was dark, nearly the same color as the yak's coat. It would further camouflage Bolin as he rode on the animal's back. It took them a while to reach the hills. Bolin had instructed the boy to take a meandering course so as not to draw suspicion. The beast's coat stank, but not nearly as bad as the smells Bolin had had to contend with while burying the rangers. It was a small price to pay, and he put up with it. As they drew closer, Bolin peered over the yak's shoulder and saw that, along with tall grass, the hill was mottled with brush.
Perfect.
Once the beasts came to the hill, they spread out and began to chew at the grass. Bolin stayed put atop Yaru, looking for some sign of activity atop the hill. There wasn't any. Apparently, the sentries were unfazed, both by the dog's earlier barking and the appearance of the yaks. The boy had said the soldiers only teased him during the daytime, again because they wanted to be sure he could see them mocking him. When he felt certain the coast was clear, Bolin slipped off Yaru's back and paused long enough to return the blanket to the boy. He put a finger to his lips, cautioning the youth not to speak, and then offered him a salute. Sitting tall astride his horse, the boy beamed and saluted back. Gun in hand, Bolin crept into the brush, moving from thicket to thicket as he made his way up the gentle slope. He was nearly all the way to the top when he spotted a brief flicker of light 20 yards to his right. One of the sentries was lighting a cigarette. His face was illuminated briefly, then he waved the match out and tossed it aside, blowing smoke as he stared out at the flatlands. Bolin carefully slipped his Desert Eagle back into his holster, then reached down and unsheathed his hunting knife. He held it behind his back to conceal the faint gleam of its 9-inch serrated steel blade, then moved away from the brush and crept stealthily the rest of the way up the hill. Bolin was less than 5 feet away before the sentry sensed him coming up from behind. He was about to turn when the executioner sprang forward, clamping his left hand over the man's mouth. Hop! In the same motion, he leaned into the man, supporting him so that he would not fall, then dragged the knife's blade across his throat, slicing into his esophagus and vocal cords, then drawing blood from a severed artery. He pulled the man down to the ground and crouched over him, watching the life fade from his disbelieving eyes. 3 more soldiers were camped halfway down the other side of the hill. One was asleep, half burrowed beneath a cheap army-issue bedroll. The other 2 were crouched before a gas lantern turned down to its lowest setting, providing just enough light to play cards by. He inched toward his prey in the tall grass. Bolin had taken the sentry's bayonet-tipped AK-47 as well as his binoculars. Quietly, he parted the grass and peered through the glasses. His blood began to churn as he focused on the flat rock the men were using as a card table. Instead of chips, the men were gambling with their battle trophies. Lying in small piles before each man were wristwatches, pocket knives, and signet rings taken off the bodies of the slain rangers. As one of the soldiers began to deal another hand, they each threw out an ante, and Bolin realized they were also wagering the severed ears and fingers of their victims. Holding his rage in check, Bolin continued to draw nearer, moving from the grass to a hedgerow of wild brush that brought him to within 10 yards of the encampment. The two card players had their assault rifles close at hand, propped against either side of the rock. Bolin wasn't about to let them bring their guns into play. Once the soldiers had picked up their cards, he made his move. Rising to a crouch, he drew his arm back, then let fly with his knife. It embedded itself in the chest of the man facing Bolin. Stunned, the man staggered backward, toppling off the log he'd been sitting on.
Chang!
The other soldier turned, reaching for his AK-47. Bolin was already on top of him, and with brutal force, he stabbed forward with his assault rifle, driving the bayonet between the soldier's ribs and twisted it, killing the sentry instantly. With no wasted motion, Bolin jerked the bayonet free and finished off the other card player, stabbing him through the heart. The skirmish had roused the third man. He was struggling to crawl out from under his bedroll when Bolin turned on him, smacking him across the skull with the butt of the AK-47. The man went down, unconscious. Wanting him alive, Bolin left the man where he lay and returned to the rock where the others had been playing cards. The lantern allowed him a better look at the grisly plunder the men had been betting with. He tossed aside his canteen, leaving room in his kit bag for the rest of the slain ranger's belongings. One of the watches in particular drew Bolin's attention. It was a moderately expensive Seiko, gold-trimmed with a worn leather band. Bolin recognized the timepiece. He picked it up and turned it over. The watch was engraved, "To Johnny Yu, with love, Mom and Pop." Jack Grimaldi had been christened John Udolph. Bolin knew the watch had been a high school graduation present. Back then, Grimaldi'd been nicknamed after legendary football quarterback Johnny Unitas. At the sudden noise, Bolin instinctively dove right, throwing himself to the ground. Glancing over his shoulder, Bolin saw a Chinese soldier twist to one side, dropping his handgun as he crumpled into the grass. The man had apparently been out on the patrol and stalked back at the sound of Bolin's confrontation with the two card players. Bolin turned his gaze uphill. There, silhouetted against the moon, the young herdsman stood holding his flintlock rifle. Bolin scrambled to his feet and rushed through the grass to where the fourth soldier had dropped from view. The man lay still on the ground. Blood seeped from a bullet hole in his right cheek. His days of pretending the boy had shot him were over.
Nice job, kid.
When the surviving Chinese soldier regained consciousness, he found himself spread-eagled on the ground, his ankles and wrists pinned to the earth by crisscrossed bayonets. Any movement and the honed blades would cut into him. He wasn't going anywhere. Bolin crouched over him, his Desert Eagle pointed at the man's forehead. The boy, Avil, stood a few paces back, trembling. Bolin hated having the boy there, but the kid refused to leave. The prisoner looked past Bolin and saw his comrades lying dead nearby. He turned his gaze on Bolin, his eyes filled with hatred.
Do you speak English?
What is it to you, Yankee imperialist dog?
Well, that answers that.
Bolin held Grimaldi's watch out where the man could see it.
What happened to the pilot? I said, what happened to the pilot?
The man refused to talk.
Hey, Avil, turn around.
When Avil did as he was told, Bolin reached out, shoving one of the bayonets deeper into the earth. Its blade cut into the prisoner's wrist.
Okay, I will talk.
That's more like it. Now, what happened to the pilot who owned this watch?
The watch? It is black market. I know nothing about a pilot.
Liar!
I'm telling the truth. I do not lie.
You bastard.
Bolin raised his fist, but thought better of it.
Avil, please turn back around.
Okay, the Rambo.
Bolin set aside the watch and grabbed the knife he'd already used on two of the other sentries. Grabbing hold of the prisoner's left hand, he spread the man's fingers and, with one fierce stroke, sliced off the right pinky. The prisoner writhed, inadvertently cutting himself on the crisscrossed bayonets pinning him to the ground. Bolin held the man's severed finger out before him.
I guess I got this off the black market, too.
Okay. We found some bodies of American soldiers and took their belongings. That's it, I swear.
I already know about the soldiers. I want to know about the pilot of the spy plane.
I only know about the soldiers, not any plane or pilot.
Liar!
Bolin glanced over his shoulder and saw that Avil was trying to sneak a look at the proceedings.
Avil, no peeking.
The boy meekly complied. Bolin turned back and leaned over the prisoner, pressing his palm hard against the bridge of the man's nose to keep his head still. With his other hand, he placed the edge of his knife against the man's ear, letting the blade cut into the lobe.
What happened to the pilot?
Okay. They took him to the labor camp.
Did you shoot the plane down? Is the pilot injured?
I don't know. All I know is that it went down a mile north of here, in the valley.
Is the pilot injured?
No. He was fine when we took him in.
Where in the labor camp were they taking him to?
I swear I don't know. I really don't.
Bolin chose not to press the matter. And as much as he wanted to ask about the killing of the Rangers, he had the information most vital to him. It was time to move on. First, however, he wanted to see to it that the military wouldn't connect Avil or anyone in the village with what had just happened.
Avil, go back to your herd now and wait for me. It'll be a few minutes.
What you to do?
Avil, go, now.
The boy obeyed. Once they were alone, Bolin turned back to the soldier, who was still stretched out on the ground, pinned by the bayonets. The man stared at him.
Even if there were a way for me to turn you in, you would never stand trial for what you did to those Rangers back there. Your superiors would let you off the hook and probably even give you a medal. That leaves what we call back home, frontier justice.
What? What is that?
Bolin grabbed one of the bayonet-fixed AK-47s and raised it in the air, but first, as if he were about to plunge a stake into the ground. Bolin brought the rifle down, driving the bayonet through the soldier's chest. Then, with cold efficiency, he pulled away the other bayonets and stripped the man to his skivvies. One by one, he quickly did the same with the others, leaving them where they had fallen. Once he was finished, he piled the uniforms in a heap near the rock where the lantern rested. He doused the lamp and poured its fuel over the clothes. There was more fuel in a 2-gallon container stored a few yards away in a crate filled with provisions. Bolin unscrewed the cap and walked about the encampment, spilling kerosene over the bodies and onto the ground and surrounding brush. When the canister was empty, Bolin tossed it aside and turned to the sentry's radio transceiver he'd seen mounted on the provisions crate. He lacked Aaron Kurtzman's knack for electronics and wasn't about to even try putting a call out to Kissinger or the Gurkhas. Instead, he grabbed the radio and smashed it against the rocks. There was one last task. Taking a few dozen small rocks bordering a fire pit near the provisions crate, Bolin rearranged them in a tight ring several yards away, then used his knife to scrawl a message in the dirt. The rocks would ensure that the message wasn't obliterated by fire. Stepping back from his handiwork, Bolin raided his kit bag for matches. Bolin fled the growing inferno, confident that by the time the military came to investigate, there would be nothing left but charred bodies and the untouched message, which would leave no doubt that the counter-massacre had been the work of an American soldier seeking retribution for the earlier killing of the Rangers. Bolin headed downhill to where Avil had gathered his herd of yaks.
Payback is a bitch.
Avil was watching the blaze with awe when Bolin caught up with him.
I'm sorry you had to see what you did.
It was like movie. You really are the Rambo.
You saved my life, Avil. Thank you. Now, you know you can't tell anybody about this.
The mother?
No one. Everybody's life depends on it. Yours, mine, your mother's, and your brother's. Now, who are you going to tell, Avil?
No one.
Good. Look, kid, you need to go now. But I have one last favor to ask.
What?
Can you ride Yaru back to town?
Yes, but I have horse.
Bolin held out a fistful of currency he'd taken off the bodies of the slain soldiers.
I need to buy the horse from you.
The ride took Bolin.